They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Necessary and Proper podcast. I'm Nate Kaczmarek, and thank you for listening. This episode is part 3 of our 6-part series featuring great discussion from our March conference on restoring Article 1, which was held here in Washington, D.C. This episode contains a conversation between Professor Susan Dudley, who is the director of the Washington University Regulatory Studies Center, and former Senator John Kyle from Arizona. The luncheon remarks touched on a range of topics, including the deterioration of the constitutional structure and its consequences for international affairs, judicial nominations, and congressional leadership. As always, please send us your feedback at articlei@fedsoc.org.
Let me begin by saying I really appreciate the work that you all do. I can remember as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee the resumes of the judicial nominees would come out, and there would be a little sticky note for us, for the Republicans on the committee, that would say he's also or she's also a member of the Federalist Society. But it was not, you didn't in polite company note that on your resume, at least when the Democrats were in charge of the committee. Now, of course, it's a badge of honor, and it just goes to show how far we've come and how far you've come, and I really appreciate that. You've got a great group of folks out in Arizona, by the way, and I've had the opportunity to get to know them and to work with them. Obviously, the Federalist Society is dedicated to the rule of law and constitutional government. That's your mission, and it's extraordinarily important. It's also under challenge today from a lot of fronts. I'll mention two. One are the true progressives who have as a goal the exercise of power unconstrained by things like the U.S. Constitution. That's how you get the living Constitution interpretations. It's how you get a vote in the United States Senate in which every single Democrat voted for a constitutional amendment to pull back on the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech, granting to Congress the right to regulate political speech. That's the kind of challenge that you can see from folks who don't have the same point of view about our founding documents. There's also another attack, but it's more of a legitimate attack. It's the natural competition, the natural political competition, to push the limits of the Constitution. Now, this was actually contemplated and actually designed by the founders, who believed that self-interested competition for power would result over time with the proper balance between both the states and the federal government and the three branches of the government here at the federal level. My experience after 26 years in the United States Congress is that as you view this question, the positions that you take are more a function of the old average, you know, old adage, where you stand is where you sit, rather than ideology. In other words, I can recall that when President Bush wanted authority to conduct war against the terrorists, I was an advocate of a little more executive power than I was during the Obama administration. And my Democratic colleagues were the precise opposite. So you see not just necessarily an ideological push, but the circumstances of the time pushing forward either executive or legislative branch power. My thesis today is that the founders would be surprised and mostly disappointed at the imbalance of powers favoring the federal government over the states and the executive over the legislative branch. I think they would also be surprised that the judicial branch is actually doing what they set it up to do, and then some. Not sure they would like what they set up in that case either. But I think the best way to look at this is to briefly remind ourselves of what the Article I powers are and how they relate to Article II powers. I'll then examine whether or not I think this is working, and if not, why not. If I have time, just a bit on judicial nominations, and finally, if I have time, a bit on the filibuster. Take a look at Article I, where Section 8 enumerates the all legislative powers in the legislative branch, and then there are some 20 other additional powers, including the Necessary and Proper Clause. Also note that the congressional powers include the right to declare war, make rules concerning captures on land and water, make rules for the government regulation of land and naval forces, calling forth the militia to execute the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. In other words, the legislative power is not, as some people have come to believe, restricted to the domestic side of things without any relation to the powers of the government to conduct war and all of those things that are related to that, including foreign policy. Congress also has some authorities that are not just expressed in Article I, including the ability to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th, and 19th Amendments and others. Now, contrast this with the executive power, and it's interesting the way the founders wrote it. First of all, the executive power shall be vested in the president, but it's undefined. What is it? Well, they wanted to limit it in one way, so that we wouldn't have a monarch, and that's why they actually declare what the oath of the president is. It's the only place in the Constitution that describes the actual wording of the oath. And of course, the oath of the president is to faithfully execute the office. This was hoped to avoid the problem of a monarch actually taking over outside the Constitution. But the powers enumerated, of course, include the commander-in-chief, but also some rather, you know, reprieves and pardons. That's not a big deal. You can make treaties with two-thirds concurrence of the Senate. You can appoint ambassadors and public ministers and fill judicial vacancies. You may convene Congress on extraordinary circumstance. You can receive ambassadors. A lot has been read into that. And, as I said, take care that the laws are faithfully executed. So you look at the two powers enumerated, and I think the founders expected that the Article I powers were far more significant than the executive, and they were literally trying to constrain the executive. But do the checks and balances really work as they intended? I contend that the answer is no. As good as they were at anticipating the problems, I don't think that they would be very happy about the way that some of these things has worked out. To start with, the Constitution, as we just noted, sets forth very general powers. And they believe that it's up to the people, as time went on, to breathe the life into what all of that meant as time went on. And I think they also appreciated that a lot of the success of the working of the government would depend, as it has, on tradition, on comity, on the respect of the branches for each other, and that there would be a common good in the mind of the people who would actually be working in the government. So the deference and restraint concept, I think, has definitely been called into question in the latter decades. That's one of the things that's caused some of the problems that we have today. In international affairs, we've seen a huge accretion of power by the executive, and there are reasons for that. First of all, it's a lot easier for him or her to act. One person, this is it. Now, Congress may eventually catch up and say, well, you didn't have the authority to do that, but it's well after the fact frequently. And in any event, with 535 members of Congress in two different bodies, with at least two different parties, it's very difficult for them to all get together and have the same ability to act quickly and decisively as the one president. And that's why in foreign affairs in particular, and certainly in military matters, you do see the president exerting more and more power. And generally, the Congress has ceded that to the president, though there have been significant exceptions, including the War Powers Act. I think the last two presidencies have illustrated why it's so hard to restrain presidential assertion of authority. When you have a President Trump coming in and using the same assertions of power to undo what the previous president did by way of executive power, You see some semblance of checks and balances working there, but it's a corrective action. You also see the courts, which I believe, if you look at all the cases, have almost uniformly pushed back on President Obama's assertion of authority outside of the constitutional authority that he was given. That's also a proper way that the checks and balances has worked. But one wonders whether after the fact, through judicial litigation, is really the best way to get at these assertions that were inappropriate in the first place. Look at the checks on the Congress. It takes both bodies to send anything to the president. And then if he vetoes it, you've still got to muster the two-thirds to override that. You've got both parties represented, as I said, and you've got both political parties in the Congress, whereas you only have one in the executive. I would also note that presidential counsel have been more assertive of presidential prerogative than anybody in the House of Representatives. We've got lawyers, but they don't have the same job that the president's lawyers, and it's whether it's Democrat or Republican, they've been very eager to defend the presidential power. So there are some things that are just set up to favor the executive in that situation. So what are the Congress's checks on the president? Well, the power of the purse has turned out to be pretty weak. Now, there are ways in which it might be exercised that could theoretically, you know, as Senator Lankford was pointing out, if you got your act together, you might be able to exert that authority. But it's pretty weak because, among other things, it requires the concurrence of the president himself to sign the bill that's being passed by the Congress. So if the Congress says we're going to hurt the president by not putting something in the bill, he doesn't have to sign it. It's not a strong check. I think one of the strongest is probably one that wasn't really intended for this purpose, but it's denying confirmations. It's a blunt instrument. I'm not going to allow this person's name to be put before the Senate for confirmation because you haven't answered my letter yet to some cabinet head. As I said, a pretty blunt instrument. It's been used rather effectively. I used it a couple of times. So it can work. I'm not sure that it was really contemplated by the founders. I think they thought impeachment would be a big check and balance, but it just doesn't turn out to be that way. It's just too big of a deal, and certainly for presidents, it just hasn't worked as I think they thought it would. One other problem here is that when you have divisions between the two legislative branches, the courts are loath to get involved, as you know, through political questions, other justiciability defenses. In effect, the courts will push off fights between the other two branches and tell them to try to work it out themselves. Occasionally, they get involved, but not frequently. So, in point of fact, I think that the checks that the founders developed that Congress could impose on the president have not been largely successful. You all know most of the reasons why the legislative branch has lost a lot of power to the executive, and most of it is the Congress's own fault. And this happens in a variety of ways. For one thing, Congress gets lazy and ends up passing legislation that isn't clear enough and therefore gives the great bureaucracy the ability to breathe a lot of its own meaning into whatever it is that Congress said. Sometimes this is even intentional. One of the ways in which we used to compromise is when the Democrat and the Republican couldn't agree, you put some fuzzy language in the middle that you could both go back to your constituents and say showed that you won the game. But of course, it's a wide open field for the courts then to try to figure out what it really means. And sometimes the tax legislation is a really good example of this. There are some really big issues that Congress just doesn't want to get that detailed with. And so it says to Treasury, you figure it out. One of these is in the regulations that will try to define what a small business really is. A lawyer or his colleagues are not a small business, but under certain circumstances, you can develop a business around the law. The latter would qualify for the 20% deduction, the former would not. But Congress didn't try to define those. It left it up to the IRS. Same thing with some other sections of the code. So with the growth of the bureaucracy, the Congress either intentionally or unintentionally leaves more and more for the bureaucracy to do. And then, of course, you've got the judicial branch seconding this motion with things like the Chevron doctrine, just concluding that the best way to deal with differences of view is to accept the bureaucracy's opinion of its own power within the executive branch, whether it conflicts with the congressional intention or not. I found one interesting example. Senator Warren, the author of the CPBP, which was definitely intended not to be accountable to Congress, and with all the different ways in which it was set up, is funded, is not accountable, and so on. She was in high dudgeon the other day from her position on the dais with some schlep from the agency there saying, you are going to have to answer our questions within 10 days or we're going to haul you back here and we're going to do this and that. And of course, the whole point of her setting it up to be not accountable was to avoid exactly what she was doing. It's a good illustration, though, of what you want to be very careful of when you set up an agency or grant powers to an agency. Congress may not have the oversight that you think that it should. All of this is, and I'm being very brief here, hopefully to lay some questions on the table that you might like to ask further. It is to make the point that I think we have more to fear from an assertion of executive power than legislative, that the checks and balances that were written into the Constitution, in point of fact, don't work that well. The ones that do work are problematic because they gum up the system even more than would otherwise be the case, like withholding confirmation and the like, so that in terms of viewing Article 1 and the powers of the legislative branch, we'd ought to do everything we can to try to encourage Congress to retake some of that authority. And one of the questions that we may have to deal with here is, well, how do you get Congress to do that? That may be one of the softball questions coming my way, but it ain't so soft. I wish I knew the answer to that, but as I said, maybe David Hoppe can tell you. Let me quickly, before 18 minutes? Okay, 1 minute on each of the following two subjects then. Judicial nominations. Senator Lankford mentioned the time constraints. Time is the biggest enemy of the leader, in the Senate in particular. It takes 3 days to get one nominee through if all of the time is used. That's got to be shortened. This is one of the cases where, while I don't like the way the rules were changed through the nuclear option, I think that it is beneficial that you can get judicial nominations through now, essentially without the filibuster, and that includes for the Supreme Court. You're all aware of how that occurred. I won't go into all of that. One quick thing on blue slips. Blue slips do play a role, particularly in the district court. There is a lot of pressure that can be brought to bear on a senator that won't return a blue slip. So even though that does gum up the system, I think you have to give the senators from a state some say in these nominations to the bench. And I'm not an opponent of the blue slip in that situation. However, I think Senator Grassley is absolutely correct when you're talking about circuit courts. You're going beyond the boundaries of just one state from which the nominee comes. And you've got the other states in the circuit to be considered. So while you can give some deference to it, it's certainly not conclusive, and the chairman of the committee has every right to go beyond that, even if the slip hasn't been returned. I'm just going to make one final point on filibustering legislation. I'm hearing on Fox News this morning people who have absolutely no idea what they're talking about, blithely talking about, yeah, well, you could deal with that if you just eliminated the filibuster. We could solve that problem, sure. Right. I wonder how happy they're going to be about that when the president is Elizabeth Warren, let's say, and the Democrats control the Congress. How will Fox then view the elimination of the filibuster, which basically grants a wide open door through which folks that they don't appreciate can just run all the legislation through that they want to? You got to think about what you're for in all circumstances, not just the day that you're or the year that you're in power. And what I have found is that as a member of the House of Representatives, I was in the minority. I had no rights. You've only got one right, and that's a motion to recommit, and it's guaranteed to fail. But that's the way it was designed. The passions of the moment of the people are to be represented in the people's body. Send it over to the Senate. You know, you guys are elected every 2 years. You're almost continually in election cycle. You're listening to the people. Gets over to the Senate. And of course, that's the saucer that's supposed to cool the coffee that's poured into it. Take your time. You got 6 years. The rules are much different. Basically, the Senate rules operates by unanimous consent, or as Mitch McConnell says, unanimous consent and jet fumes. If you want something done, put it on just before all the planes leave on Thursday afternoon. It'll go through real quickly, I guarantee you. But otherwise, it's unanimous consent. That's really what the filibuster is. It's I object. And just to take 1 minute on this, what that does is substitute for a rules committee in the House, under which every piece of legislation is debated pursuant to a rule that outlines exactly the time of debate, who gets to say what amendments are offered, what they say, and all the rest of it. In the Senate, there is nothing like that. And so when the leader says, I now ask unanimous consent that we move, proceed to Senate bill such and such, anybody, his party or the other party, can stand up and say, well, I object. Well, immediately, time out, quorum call. He comes over to the objector and says, well, why did you object? Well, I didn't know you were going to bring it up. Well, we had been talking about it. Yeah, but now you're actually doing it. And I haven't gone back and checked with the folks that I represent to see whether they, you know, what they think about this. Well, you need to do that now. Well, okay, but that in the meantime, we're not going to do anything. How many amendments do you think that we could offer? Well, how many do you need? Do you see what's happening now? Senators are getting together to try to work things out. And I know it's frustrating when you're in the majority that you just can't ram everything through with your 50 votes plus the vice president. But believe me, when you're in the minority, you appreciate the fact that you've got some power in the Senate as a member of the minority. And it all boils down to, would you rather have the ability to stop something or the ability to ram it through over the objection of a bare minority? And you can make an argument either way. But over time, I've come to believe that the ability to stop something is ultimately more important than the ability to jam your particular great idea through. And that's why it's important that the filibuster remain in the Senate. By the way, if you want to enforce it, all the presiding officer has to do is insist that the objector be on the floor and continue to state his or her objection. If you leave the floor, the presiding officer has the perfect right to say, is there any objection? Hearing none, the Senate will proceed to whatever, whatever. So it's just the comity over the years that has created the tradition that an objector doesn't really have to be on the floor or stay on the floor, and that somebody else can make the objection on his behalf, and that people will respect that until they can work out the issue, that has resulted in the filibuster taking as much time as it has. I'm going to stop there, having thrown out quite a bit of different things here, and we're going to have a conversation now about this or anything else that I haven't thought of here.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Senator. I think that really did build on what we heard this morning, a lot of what we heard this morning. And one of the first questions that Gene asked of our morning panel was, what could we do to incentivize Congress to take more responsibility and be more accountable? I think you gave us some. And you also told us we're going to wait for Mr. Hopp in the afternoon.
Yeah, well, David, I saw David earlier. David was my chief of staff when I was whip, Republican whip, for the last year plus. And he's worked for the Speaker of the House. He's been around a long time. He really does know the institutions, and he appreciates the value of the traditions in the institutions, but he's also seen how they don't work very well. And he's got some ideas, and I don't even know exactly what they are. But it's a hard question, and I'm not sure that it is the rules or the procedures or the system itself as much as the attitude of the people who are there that has created the problem over time. I think that a lot of the Constitution and the rules of the House and the Senate and traditions of the Senate would actually accommodate really good solutions to all of these problems with the right attitude, but that a very super party partisanship has rendered both parties incapable of bending a little bit to accommodate the other side and therefore allow the process to work. I've forgotten which novel it was. I think it had to do with the French Revolution, and the lady's sitting there knitting, and she says, reform. I couldn't find it in Tale of Two Cities. Anyway, she says, reform, sir, don't talk of reform. Things are bad enough already. And if you look at every election reform, McCain-Feingold, Exhibit 1. They always ended up with bad unintended consequences. They didn't solve the problem. It usually made matters worse. So without being specific, I think that better leadership is required. And now we can talk about what makes better leadership.
So I now have my dates. You were in the House from 87 to 95, mm-hmm. and then the Senate from 95 to 2013. Always reelected with wide margins. Did you see a change during that time? And have you seen change since then?
Yes.
And are there things that you can point to that may have caused that?
I can point to some. I'm as frustrated as everyone about exactly how it's come about and what to do about it. But I think there are a whole variety of things. There is less appreciation for the institutions themselves, and therefore protecting the institutions. And that means, for example, protecting the legislative's prerogatives vis-a-vis the executive branch. On the other hand, I saw a lot of those old crusty people that had been here forever, and boy, they were into tradition and into their power of their little committee and all of this kind of stuff, and a lot of that stuff wasn't good. And so the revolution of the people after Newt Gingrich in 1995 made some really big, important changes, I think. So a lot of these things have two sides. I think cable TV and talk radio and other media have really been a big part of the problem, but I wouldn't do anything to limit what any of them say. Let me hasten to say that. But they make everything political, winners and losers. What's the state of the game? What's the score as of right now? And you never get into the reasoning behind things. And by the way, the assumption always is that whatever is done for political purposes only. Now, that may be because that's the way they think, but it also may be because that's the way that a lot of it is these days. But it's not true with everything. And so right after one election, the next election starts. Well, what do you think is going to happen 2 years from now in the midterms? Whoa, can we hold off for a little bit? I remember that it seemed like after an election, you had about a year, 14 months to make deals with the other side and legislate. And then you'd kind of go off to your own corners and say, well, we've got an election coming up in 8 months, so we better start being more partisan. Harry Reid, as Democratic leader, I don't know if he'd admit this, but he actually told his folks at one point, stop co-sponsoring legislation with Republicans. They just want that for cover so they can appear to be bipartisan. Well, there's some truth to that, but it's also true that unless you have nothing happens in the Senate that isn't bipartisan, except in extraordinarily rare circumstances. So there's a lot that has been politically motivated, and I'm not talking about philosophically motivated. I could make deals with liberal Democrats just fine if power for parties was not involved. But today, it seems like everything revolves around the notion, if I do anything to compromise, you have more power and I have less, and therefore I can't give it up. It's all about power now rather than principle or governing. And how it got to be, as I said, that I've given you some of the reasons. I think the media has a lot to do with it. But I've concluded that there's only one answer that I can think of that makes sense, and that's better leadership. And again, how you get that is another subject.
Yeah, it's challenging. Now, one of the things that you mentioned is that, and you mentioned this several times in your remarks, that where your view on how much executive power was too much, or how much the executive really depended on whether you liked what they were doing and who was in office. I'm very interested in regulatory reform. Do you think that presents an opportunity now that some members who were not enthusiastic about more congressional accountability over regulations may be very interested in accountability or an ability to, as you said, Senator Warren, her view of the CFPB has changed dramatically from the agency she created with no accountability to the agency she now wants to be accountable to her. Do you think there are chances now for reforms, legislative reforms to regulatory process that might make some of these agencies more accountable?
I think you've described the dynamic that has to exist in order for the reforms to occur. Unfortunately, I'm not sure we have the time right now, nor do circumstances warrant it. Time, first of all, I think a lot of people are waiting to see what happens, 8 months from now or 7 months from now. And so they're not willing to stake anything on the status quo, because things may change after the midterm election. I also think that there is an undeniable Trump element in all of this that makes some people irrational. And you just cannot agree with the other side. Otherwise, you're going to be criticized for agreeing, making a deal with the devil. And on the Republican side, we've got the power. Don't compromise with the Democrats at all. Compromise is a bad word. So, I mean, that's where we've come. If the situation were longer term and more stable, the circumstances you describe are the kinds that might result in some compromise.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we have time for a few questions of Senator Kyle.
Bill Klein, I'm a retired Army physician. I fully agree with your point about the need for better leadership, but I'm also an advocate for better followership. And I wonder what you think of the fact that in the last election, almost 40% of eligible voters didn't vote, and probably among those that did, an awful lot of them made the right vote for the wrong reason. And what are we up to, about 70, 80, 90% who don't even know their three branches of the government, civics and all that subject. Yeah. But the followership issue is something we don't hear much about, and good followers are necessary in groups.
Absolutely. You know that from being in the military. And thanks for your service. There are two things I'd like to address there. First of all, one of the reasons that Congress hasn't addressed the big thing that everybody recognizes needs to be addressed, namely our entitlement spending, which is what's really driving us into bankruptcy, is because the people don't want it addressed. The people want all of that stuff, and they don't want to have to pay for it. And if you try to touch it, they're gonna get you politically. Now that is so. That's the way the system is designed, politicians being responsive to their constituency, but is it? This is where real leadership comes in. Winston Churchill explained to the people of Great Britain why they needed to fight and how they could win if they stuck together. There aren't very many leaders today that are willing to take on the tough education function of a leader, to tell the people why they need to be willing to make a teeny, teeny sacrifice for their own entitlement in order that the country survive. We haven't had a president, and there are very few members of Congress except Paul Ryan who have been willing to do that. This is where leadership comes in. You can't just accept the opinions of a public, which by definition can't be as well educated on all these issues as the policymakers are. So I think followership is important. The people have an obligation to be educated. That's what our founders believed and assumed, and our schools are not providing that education. It's up to leaders to be able to do that and have the courage to risk not being elected in order to do so. There was something else I wanted to address in your question. I forgot now what it was. Hopefully that at least gets to the point.
Lauren Hershey, I'll say a retired attorney, Department of Justice experience, including the Antitrust Division and the breakup of AT&T back in the early 80s. Thank you for your remarks. I'm curious about one little iota that came out this morning, and I think Senator Lankford may have addressed it as well. This idea that continuing resolutions began in 1995, and you were in Congress at that time. It seems to be one of the banes of our existence. Could you address that?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that kind of crept in. Well, we didn't have it all done, so we needed to tide ourselves over for a week until we got it done. A continuing resolution won't hurt anything. So, okay. So it gets started that way. And then it becomes obvious to people, hey, we can be lazy about this. We've got an out. We can always just do a CR and not get our work done. And pretty soon it became too politically difficult to get the work done, so we started relying on CRs. And then when you begin doing that, the next thing that leads to is the omnibus, namely, you're not even doing CRs for each of the 13 appropriation bills, the 13 bills that together constitute the funding for all of the federal government. You can't even get that done. You might get a few done, but all the remaining ones go in one giant spending bill, the exact thing that Senator Lankford was talking about. And those are impossible votes. I mean, how do you vote on a bill that 55% of the stuff you think is good and 45 is really bad? Okay, so how do you vote? You got to keep the government running. You really like the increase in defense spending. That's what I was going to, the other thing I was going to mention. CRs make defense planning impossible. I'm on a commission now to make recommendations on defense strategy to the Pentagon and to the Congress. And the number one problem that all of the commanders talk about is the inability to make long-term planning, which in the military, if you're going to buy an F-35, how many years does it take to design it, to test it, to build it, to get it fielded, and all the rest of it? And if you've got one-year funding through a CR that says you have to spend the money the same way you spent it last year, remember, a CR is a continuing resolution. Continue spending the money the way you did last year. So you can't do anything new. Now, we've got a bipartisan agreement for nuclear modernization. We've allowed our entire triad and nuclear facilities and weapons to deteriorate to the point that there's an enormous amount of funding necessary to get it all back up to be the deterrent that we need it to be. That's about a 15-year program. Okay, we've got 2 years of funding to start on programs which in the future will need large quantities of money, not too much, we can afford it, but quantities of money that haven't been in the budget heretofore. So do they bet on the come and say, we've got 2 years worth here, we're going to assume it'll all be there, there's a big bow wave out there though in the future, it'll have to be ramped up, but once you start it, you can't stop it. I mean, once you start building a new submarine or you start the planning for it, what are you going to do then, stop it after 2 years because you don't have any more money? The Pentagon can't operate this way, and the same with other branches, as Senator Lankford said. So it's one of the most insidious inventions of the Congress and results in extraordinarily wasteful and poor policy.
All right, I think this will be our last question based on time.
Hi, my name is Samira Daniels. I've been more in the foreign policy community. But I wanted to go back to your point about the educative function of, you know, leadership. And it seems that there is, of the congressional staff, but what do you see as a process by which, you know, a senator or a congressman can have that educative, because with what it's being supplanted by the news, these news blimps of, you know, different, you know, like Lindsay and others, and I think that is really the fastest way of progress for this country.
I think I got the gist of it. How do you create the leadership to take on the tough challenges courageously? Right, the educational function. And I think the irony is that people yearn for good, strong leaders who explain things to them. And so in one sense, it's always been odd to me that nobody's willing to take on the job of explaining why we need entitlement reform, for example. Our commission's going to try to take on the job of explaining why we need to spend a lot more on defense in order to be able to defend our nation. It's not easy. If you're in office, you run the risk that the other side will demagogue it and hurt you politically. But if you're confident enough of your point, and you have courage, and you have the ability to explain, then you have an obligation to explain. And to me, the amazing thing is how well it works if you do it. Now, Paul Ryan, the first time he trotted out his budget, he was a house of one. Nobody wanted to go along with that and vote for his budget. By the third time, he had, I don't know if it was unanimous, but almost all Republicans supported his budget. They saw that you could get away with supporting something reasonable if you could go back to your constituents and explain it. And so they weren't punished as much as they thought they were going to be in the very beginning. So I really think that's what it all boils down to. But the American people have to decide that they want to elect people who won't just cater to their desires, but who will genuinely lead them as a leader ought to do, and then be willing to follow those leaders. Easier said than done, I know. That's the job of the Federalist Society, to back up the people who are willing to do this. And if passed as prologue, I think you can be successful primarily in the judicial area to do that. And I encourage you to continue on. Thank you much.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.